I'm Jenny Carpenter from the South Yorkshire Climate Alliance and been invited to chair this evening. We're absolutely delighted to have Anne Pettiful with us, and she is a person of considerable reputation and the winner of the Hannah Arendt Prize for Political Thinking.
Wow.
Not just thinking, but actually sharing your thoughts. And we're very pleased that you're here to share some of your thoughts tonight. There's a rather intriguing title to this, as you have seen. Is there time for a Green New Deal? We haven't a lot of time tonight, I'm afraid, because Anne has got to get back to London, and there is the last reasonable train is at 9 o'clock, so she's going to be having to leave at 8:30. So be thinking quickly of your questions. We'll have time for a few questions, I'm sure. But I'm just warning you now. Just a reminder that the Hope for the Future session that was to be been planned has had to be cancelled because not enough people booked for it. So that is off. But there is a chance to hear Ian Rotherham on Thursday afternoon in the Botanical Gardens. Anyway, I'm sure most of you have got copies of the brochure. Don't miss all the other things. And I'm going to plug very naughtily the play on Friday, which is written and directed by Francis Gray, no less, the chair of the Broomhill Festival. And if you are politically minded, as I suspect that most of you here are, I think you will enjoy it. It derives from Gulliver's Travels, but it is very contemporary in its application. So now, with no further ado, I'll hand over to Anne. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jenny. Thank you. Thank you very much for including me in this festival and inviting me here tonight. Am I too loud? I'm sounding very loud. Is that okay? Everyone can
have to speak slightly slower.
Right, okay. I shall try and speak slowly. But I'm just taken back to the Jubilee 2000 days, but also to the days of Operation Noah, because for a few years, up until the Copenhagen conference in 2005, I was the sort of lead campaigner for Operation Noah. So when it comes to thinking about is there time, I think we've run out of time. I don't think there is time. And I say this in all seriousness, because back in 2003, we were urging the churches to divest. We were urging the church people to change, to transform the church to ensure greater sustainability. And clearly, that is a struggle that Operation Noah is still engaged in. I notice that there are still problems with the church's pension funds, investing in ExxonMobil, and so on. So I can see that there's been agitation, there's been protests, there's been action, but absolutely nothing has changed. So the IPCC produced its first report in 1992. And since then, greenhouse gas emissions have steadily risen. There has been absolutely no indication of greenhouse gas emissions sliding back or falling. They continue to rise. It's as if nothing has been done in all that time since 1992. And there are reasons for that, because there have been very forceful obstructions to action on climate breakdown, from the fossil fuel companies, from big corporations, from big money, from Wall Street. And they have done everything possible to block changes, to block the cutting of emissions. And one of those things is, for example, the idea of a carbon footprint. The idea of a carbon footprint is that we all are responsible for the rate of emissions, for the level of toxic emissions, for the fact that emissions are still rising and haven't stopped rising since 1992. And if you doubt what I'm saying, may I refer you to the work of Professor Kevin Anderson at the Tyndale Centre at Manchester University, who's very clear about all of this. So the fact of the matter is that we've tried all kinds of things, and the corporates have, for example, suggested that we all have a carbon footprint, that the fact that we suffer from climate breakdown is all of our responsibility. And that's not true. Those responsible hugely for the rate of emissions and the fact that emissions are still rising are the top 10% of the population. I'm included in that category, if I may say so, and I imagine there are some of you here that are included in that category. But not everybody is in that category. But the top 10% and the top 1% are the most responsible for the bulk of emissions. If their emissions were halved by 50%, according to Professor Anderson, to the level of emissions the average European, we could cut emissions by a third in a year. But it's not happening. The top 10% are instead saying, actually, everybody has to change, and everybody has to change simultaneously. And that is really difficult to achieve. So nothing is happening. And there's another scam, which is the way in which we calculate emissions. So we use false accounting, and that's not accidental either. It was agreed at the Paris Agreement, and it was agreed with big corporates that we would, for example, not include airlines and emissions when counting Britain's greenhouse gas emissions. Airlines and shipping emissions, sorry, when counting Britain's greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, we don't count the emissions that we've outsourced to China, to Bangladesh, to Africa, and to Latin America. We don't make the stuff that we consume. That's all made mostly in China. And they are burning coal to build the products and the goods that we demand that are shipped across to us, including the iPhone that I use, right? But we don't count those as our emissions. We call them China's emissions, and we blame China for burning coal. So we have this system of avoiding facing the reality of our emissions. So we claim that we're cutting greenhouse gas emissions here in Britain, but by excluding airlines and shipping and outsourced emissions, we make it sound as if something is happening. And actually, if we look at the Earth, the planet, understands one thing, which is total emissions. The atmosphere isn't divided up into little packets with Britain here and China there and the United States there. The planet has one atmosphere, right? And that is where the emissions, you know, are expanded to. And they are still rising. Nothing has changed. And back in 2003, we were protesting, we were demonstrating, we were using the story of Noah to sort of highlight. We were doing everything possible to bring these issues to the attention of the churches. And that was 19 years ago. And the emissions are still rising. So I'm beginning to feel that actually, no, we don't have time. We don't have time. And what are we going to do about that? Well, we've got to start thinking about how to act. I personally, and I'm saying this within these four walls, I think protest and agitation is now a waste of time. Standing outside ExxonMobil and saying, please be kind and stop burning oil, when oil is so profitable, when it's so much more profitable than solar and wind, is an utterly pointless activity. They're not going to change, right? And so I'm beginning to argue that we have to go beyond protest and agitation. We've got to start thinking about direct action. We've got to remember how the ANC brought down apartheid. They didn't do it by standing outside embassies and asking people to be kind to black South Africans. They took direct action. That's what was needed to bring about the transformation. When women campaigned for the suffrage, they began certainly by begging politicians to give women the vote. But in the end, they understood that to bring about that shift in power away from men and towards women, they had to do more. They had to engage in direct action. Now, I'm sure you're all peaceable, loving people, but I'm arguing to you that we have no time. I stand here thinking, when is the next calamity going to happen? And how devastating is it going to be? And how global is it going to be? Or is it once again going to be confined to Bangladesh or to some remote part of Latin America? Or even to the drought-stricken regions of the United States, which don't even get into our news these days, right? There are catastrophes happening everywhere, and we're almost blind to them. But is there going to be something total, something big that's going to happen? Is an ice shelf going to collapse and flood and raise sea levels and eliminate whole cities? You know, some of the biggest cities in the world are on the coast. If you think about New York, if you think about London, these cities, these very, very big cities, are very, very vulnerable. New York was nearly brought down by Hurricane Sandy not long ago. And I know, for example, I have a friend who lives in an apartment block on the Hudson River, and they were told that in order to prevent the next crisis, all the electricity and the electrical kit that's in the basement of the block had to be moved to the top floor. Well, it hasn't happened. It's still in the basement, right? So the kind of changes that had to be invested in, that had to have money spent on to bring about a transformation for New York, some of them have happened, but very little has happened. So will the next catastrophe be in a major city with millions and millions of inhabitants? Who knows? But we do know, and the scientists keep ramming home to us, that it's very, very serious, that we have no time. And so I want to argue that I want to argue for more direct action. There's a man called Andreas Malm, a Swede, who's written books about this, and I recommend that you take a look at them. But I want to bring it back to where we are right now. And I want to talk about the oil price. Not just the oil price, but also the price of grain. These are two markets, which are devastating the global economy. As I speak, the financial system is balancing on the brink, right? It's extraordinarily volatile. Crypto is crashing, thank God. It's been such an evil thing, the crypto system. But an awful lot of people are losing billions of dollars as we stand here, right? And a lot of very ordinary people, very poor people, who put their savings into crypto on the advice of, for example, film stars like Matt Damon, they're going to lose their money. And they're going to be very angry. And it's going to be very hurtful. I once went back to South Africa, my home country, and visited my family who live in a very poor part of Johannesburg and who are not very well off. And they asked me what I thought about crypto. And I said, it's a grand Ponzi scheme and it'll collapse. And they said, no, it isn't, Auntie Anne, they said, because we've put our money in there. We've got rich quite quickly. We've made a lot of money. And I found it very hard to persuade them to get out as quickly as possible. I hope they have got out. But today we know that millions of people have been ripped off by the system. So that's part of the financial system that is at the moment in the process of collapsing. But the rest of the financial system is looking very, very vulnerable because it's overburdened by debt, and the central banks are talking about just lifting interest rates in the case of the United States. They said by 0.50 basis points, but it might now be 0.75. This is hardly any shift. And already the whole infrastructure is beginning to wobble. And that's because there are loads of corporates out there that borrowed crazy money. And with every rise in interest rates, their ability to repay that debt diminishes, right? And they're beginning to wobble. And people are losing confidence. Should I have put all my money in that SPAC? There's a SPAC called Cazoo, which is a British company, which is a website for buying and selling cars, which is going bust as we speak. And this company is part of something called a SPAC, which is a special purpose vehicle, it was called. And the idea is called a blank check investment. In other words, these are companies pretty much as operated in the South Sea bubble, you know, which is a company to do something of which will be made clear later in the day, right? People were asked to hand over money for investments that they weren't to be told what they were for. And Cazoo was one of those SPAC companies. People threw billions, millions at this company, expecting it to make loads of money. Today it's crashing. And a lot of money is going to be lost. And they decided, although it's a British company, they decided to register in New York for reasons that have to do with regulation or the avoidance of regulation. And loads of New Yorkers, Americans, global investors put money into this, and it's crashing now. So we're seeing the financial system already looking deeply unstable and volatile. And volatility is what always happens before a crash. So we've got a very unstable global financial system. But unfortunately, because of the way we are and because of the preoccupations of our media and of our politicians, our focus tends to be on the boundaries of the country within which we live. And many of you here, I know, have internationalist perspectives, are interested in Africa, in Latin America, in China, and what's going on in the rest of the world. But on the whole, our perspective as a nation is what's happening here. Our obsession is what's happening in Westminster. Our obsession is with what is domestic. But actually, our world is governed not by Westminster, not by Whitehall, but by international global markets, which are beyond the reach of our governments, right? And the market in oil and grain is at this moment inflicting the most extraordinary destructive damage on the world and on the world's poor above all. So what is the global market in oil? It is a market which is managed mainly in Wall Street and in Chicago, and to an extent in London and also Frankfurt. And it's managed by big global corporations, the big five oil companies and the big grain corporations, Glencore, Vitol, those sorts of companies, right? They manage these markets. And of course, the price of oil and the price of grain is largely dependent on supply and demand. And Russia, of course, is playing games and blocking the supply of grain and pouring oil into the global economy, right? So there are supply and demand issues. But ultimately, that global market, which our government can have do nothing about, operates in Wall Street and Chicago, and there speculators amplify the price of oil or grain. They amplify it or they might dampen it. It depends. It depends on their speculative moods, basically. But they want to make money, and they make millions, if not billions, of dollars out of whether or not the grain price goes up a cent or 10 cents or goes down 10 cents or 5 cents, basically. And within those margins, if you buy in enough volume, you can make enormous sums of money. So the combination of supply and demand and of speculation is what determines this global price, which is beyond the management of our government or of us here. So I was in Spain last week, and the Spanish have got solar and wind power. 45% of their energy is supplied by both solar and wind. They don't need to be attached to a gas and an oil price, which is fixed globally on spot markets, as they're called. But they are bound up in the European Union, and the European Union in turn is bound to adhere to this global market price. The Prime Minister of Spain is trying to decouple Spain from that system, and he can't do that, right? But if, 90% of their energy came from wind and solar, would they be able to detach themselves, the price of that energy, from global markets? That's the question that we have to ask, right? So the point I want to make is this. While we worry about what's going on here, the fact is that out there are speculators and gamblers, essentially, making enormous amounts of money out of these very high prices for oil and grain. And nobody can tax them. Nobody can deal with them. Why? Because we've agreed to an international financial system based on capital mobility, on the ability of Amazon or Vitol or Glencore or Facebook to move their capital gains and their profits across borders without any friction, without any hindrance. If you want to cross a border, you have to have a passport. You have to fill in forms. You have to be vetted. You have to have your photograph taken. And the border guards can stop you from crossing the border. If you want to trade across borders, ask Northern Ireland, you meet frictions and barriers. But if you want to move capital, there's virtually no friction and no capital. And that's the reason why these markets are global and why they operate at the global level, and they are self-regulating, essentially. So I'm saying this to you because what I'm arguing in the Green New Deal is that we have to transform that international financial system. We have to bring all that capital back on shore. And we have to bring it on shore in order to manage it. I don't like using the word control. I just want to see the system managed so that it doesn't get massively imbalanced. Because one of the reasons we're going to have another global financial crash is that the financial system is massively imbalanced. We have high levels of debt and low levels of income. We have the gains of the 1%, and we have the stagnant wages of the 99%. We have trade imbalances. Countries like Germany with massive surpluses, and countries like Spain with deficits. China with a massive surplus, the United States with a massive deficit. And these imbalances cause trade tensions, which lead to trade wars, which lead to real wars, right? And that's because the system is out there, the financial system is self-regulating, does what it wants to do, spouts oil, fixes the price of grain, regardless of what you and I want or care about or do. And so, for me, the urgency is to transform the system. And I know we can do it because we've done it before. The Green New Deal is based on what happened in the United States in 1933 when President Roosevelt came to power. On the night of his inauguration, on the Saturday night of his inauguration, he said to his staff, "We are going to dismantle the gold standard." And the gold standard in 1933 was the globalization of its day. It was government by Wall Street. It was governed by the City of London. And by that I mean the City of London and Wall Street were responsible for fixing the exchange rate, for the rate of interest on loans, for the mobility of capital, for the levels of investment. All of this was done by the private sector, by Wall Street and the City of London. And he said, no, we're a democratically elected government. We want to be able to make those decisions. And his finance minister, Henry Morgenthau, said, we moved the government from Wall Street to my office at the Treasury. And the truly remarkable thing about Roosevelt was he did it on the night of his inauguration. He said to his staff, "We're going to end the gold standard for the United States. I want the banks to hand over all their gold, and from now on, we will determine the exchange rate. We will determine these important policy levers for the economy." And his staff said, "You can't do it because tomorrow's a holy day. You're going to have to wait until Monday." So he closed the banks on the Monday. And everybody thinks of that as the day in which he fixed the banks. But no, it was the day in which he closed the banks in order to collect the gold and shift the power to determine these important levers of the economy from Wall Street to the Treasury. And that began a massive transformation in the United States, which had had a great financial crisis in 1929, which had high levels of unemployment, but above all, had a major ecological crisis called the Dust Bowl. And Roosevelt and his administration were able to tackle all of those issues. Now, the United States is a big, powerful country, and it was even then. But Roosevelt faced the rise of fascism. Randolph Hearst, who was the big media mogul of his day, was the one who invented the term America First and was really egging on the right, the far right and the fascists, challenging Roosevelt, right? And he faced them and faced them down and transformed the United States' economy almost overnight. It took time to create jobs, it took time to tackle the Dust Bowl, it took time to employ the people, it took time to plant 4 billion trees to deal with soil erosion, etc., etc. But in the process, he healed the economy and he healed the ecological collapse in those states where soil had been eroded so devastatingly. And that is the model, because subsequently, the whole world came off the gold standard. Roosevelt was invited by the bankers to go to a conference in 1933 to restore the gold standard worldwide, and he refused to go. He said, "No, I'm not playing ball." And as a result, the gold standard collapsed in the rest of the world. So what I'm saying is, we've seen in history that it is possible to bring about a big global transformation overnight. It takes leadership, it takes courage, it takes having John Maynard Keynes on your side, but it can be done, right? And we need to do that now, because if we want to manage oil prices, if we want to manage the profitability of oil firms, if we want to ensure that people can be fed in Egypt, where millions of people face starvation because they import grain from mainly from Russia and Ukraine, where we know that throughout the Middle East there are going to be the most awful riots and crises, as there were in 2011 when the grain prices rose there, we would be able to manage all of that, but we can't manage it if there are if the invisible hand is managing global markets in these vital commodities, vital not just to the economy, but also to the ecosystem. So, you know, this is not a cheerful message. This is not a helpful and hopeful message. But I hope that what I'm conveying to you is the sense of urgency that we need to adopt, and how we really have to think about how very far we have not got, how we've not got very far. 19 years ago, churches were trying to bring about a transformation, and we've not changed anything. Emissions are still rising. The planet is warming, and it's warming and likely to warm catastrophically for human civilization at least. And so I want to just leave with that, you know, with that in your minds, because I think we have to think of a different way, and we have to have the courage to face the truth, because what's happened is that the big oil companies have been trying to hide the truth, have been trying to conceal the real threat that we face. So I'm going to stop on that rather grim note, and let's see if there are any questions.
Thank you.
on earth can we stop investments in fossil fuels?
The thing is, I think, I mean, first of all, we have to go after the investors, and many of them are ourselves. We're the ones whose pensions depend on these. The reason why the Church of England can't stop investing in fossil fuels is because we demand to have decent pensions in our old age. Having lived the good life, in a sense, over the last 50 years, because we've benefited from the oil-fueled economy that we've lived through, we're now demanding decent pensions. So in a way, we have to start asking the questions of ourselves. But I think, above all, we, you know, I mean, to be honest, I think this is something that I want us to talk about. Well, how do you think we can stop investment in fossil fuel companies? What can we do to them that will make them change their tune? What will we do to them that will hurt their profits? And, you know, some people have talked about tackling pipelines. There's a wonderful campaign called Stop the Oil, I think it's called. Stop Oil. And they have a simple, single demand. And this is the other good thing about this campaign, which is mainly young people, is that, A, they're taking direct action. They've been down in tunnels tackling oil pipes and that kind of thing. But B, they have a very simple ask, which there should be no new oil investments. And they were at the, where were they yesterday? At the Bank of England, I think it was. And they splattered red blood paint all over the building and so on. It's that kind of direct action that I think is disturbing of the system and that might do something to change it. But I honestly think that we've got to get creative about that. We've got to, you know, we have to organize. So number one, I would say, how do we stop investment in oil? Well, first of all, we've got to get ourselves organized. The point always to cheer us on is the fact that there's far more of us than there is of them. But we need to organize for that. So, you know, support, what is it called? Do you know? Does someone know the actual name? I think it's, what's it? Just Stop Oil. That's what it's called. Yeah.
Thank you. Somebody else? Another question?
Thank you very much for your talk. What is the probability that we go down the road to fascism as we end up with people discovering that their investments or their pensions have collapsed? Their lifestyle is being damaged because of the rising cost of living, and they complain about that. But equally, they complain about the loss of their own comfortable lives because of the very direct action that you're talking about. There's been tremendous pushback, even in Sheffield, against people, you know, putting in little bits of bollards to reduce traffic in neighborhoods. Do you not think that there is a big danger in developed countries that actually we don't have majority of people yet on board, and therefore we get overruled?
Yeah.
And we get police and criminal evidence bills and all those things.
Yes. Jenny, do you want to take more questions? Thank you for that question.
Sorry, this is going to sound a bit trivial after all that, but one of the things that I see as a campaigner coming out is all these, you know, we get narratives that, you know, we're totally committed to net zero by 2050, all this. And then you get other narratives like levelling up as opposed to levelling down, which, when you think about it, increases consumption. And the cost of living crisis is portrayed as general, so we have to reduce taxes. So we lose that part of a large part of the economy in social services and council workers and planners and all this sort of thing. So do you agree that all these narratives, there's lots of counter narratives to actually
make it
prevent action?
Yeah.
And how do you challenge them?
Yeah.
Thank you. one point and then a question. Some of us here are from Extinction Rebellion, and we did Occupy Lloyd's of London Insurance Company in April.
Yes.
And evidently the news of that went round all the financial institutions in the world.
Yeah.
So I think some of us felt quite, you know, that's something that we can do. Mm. The other question, some of us are also in Green New Deal, UK, and have been very inspired by the global Green New Deal, which, you, as you probably know, is Caroline Lucas and Clive Lewis and others. And for about 30 countries, MPs in 30 countries have signed up to this. Mm. And part of it is about transforming the financial institutions. So it's not just starting on fossil fuels or forests, it's actually targeting the finances.
Yeah.
And these MPs are committed to work in any way they can to challenge those institutions and bring the capital back into the countries.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering what you think about that and how that can get more coverage or campaign around. Mm. Yeah, so that's my question.
Right, okay. So can I take those three, Jenny? Yeah. So will we get fascism? I think it's very likely, but not for the reasons to do with the climate, but to do with the system. And I take inspiration here from Karl Polanyi, who explained what happened in the 1930s and 40s in terms of people feeling helpless because government said, sorry, we can't do it, we can't help you. This is nothing to do with us, it's the market. We can't help you with your oil bills because the market is deciding this. It's nothing to do with us. And so what people did then is that if the government that I've voted for and elected can't help me, I will turn to a strong man who's promising, Trump, Bolsonaro, Orban, Putin, you name it, to protect me from those market forces, right? So I think we're already in that phase. And what's extraordinary is, of course, the United States is far more weaponized than Germany was in 1933. So it's terrifying as we think about the coming elections in the United States and the rise and the ability that Trump might come back again. So I think part of our problem, and this comes back to the narratives that you spoke of, the net zero narratives as well, and the cost of living crisis and so on. We're living through this economic crisis, which makes it very hard to think about this climate crisis, because, I mean, I'm just trying to survive here, and I'm not just protecting my own interests. Lots of people are just trying to get food on the table for their kids, right? And to keep the energy flowing in winter. So naturally, that's going to turn people inwards. So again, it comes back to this system, this economic system is doing this to people and making it very much harder for us to work together, to cooperate, to coordinate, not just in our own communities, but internationally. You know, because these markets are creating such tensions globally that, you know, Europe is divided, Europe and Britain is divided, the United States is split in half. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if the United States doesn't have a civil war. You know, the third world, so-called, that used to be, you know, would unite around people like President Nyerere and so on. No longer, there isn't that cohesive force there anymore. So we have this splintering, which is a result of the way in which the economic system inflicts pain and division and tensions on societies. And within that, trying to transform the ecosystem makes it really very difficult, which is, in a sense, why we have to deal with the economy first. But these are all big things to do. But they can be done in crises. You know, we're in the throes of another financial crisis. I predicted the 2007-09 crisis for my sins. I wrote a book which was published in 2006 called The Coming First World Debt Crisis. I was very against the title because I thought that by the time it was published in September 2006, the crisis would have come and my book would be out of date. I also didn't like First World, Third World, or blah. But I had no... contract meant that the publisher decided on the title. But in fact, the crisis didn't come until August 2007, and most people didn't even know there was a crisis until layman's in 2008. And I thought, right, this is the moment. We'll transform the world because it's going to collapse and we'll all have realized what a catastrophic thing this is and we'll change it. But we all stood there with our mouths open saying, we didn't know this could happen. When I say we, I mean prime ministers, finance ministers, the governor of the Bank of England, the governor of the Federal Reserve. Alan Greenspan said he didn't think this could happen. And so what happened? The financial system consolidated itself. It's got bigger and badder and more dangerous since then. Because we didn't understand it. We didn't know what had happened. We weren't prepared. We hadn't thought about it. And so when it happened, we were stunned. We were impotent. And so I think what I'm trying to say to you is, it's going to happen again. It's happening now. It's really important for us to understand it, to know what's happening, to think about it, and to be prepared. Because then at least we can talk to each other about it and decide what to do and decide to change it. But in 2008, we couldn't even decide to change it because we were all so stunned. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? And while I cough away. So the narratives, the net zero narrative is a scam. It's a way of saying, let's defer getting to zero by offsetting. We'll plant some trees, and that means we can build a new airport because we've planted some trees in the Amazon or wherever we may have planted them. We'll offset our emissions. You know, there's all that bullshit that gets talked about it. I hate using the term net zero because it's designed to block and to defer action. But unless we're aware of that and we don't, repeat it, we don't parrot what they're saying, but we challenge what they're saying, it's not going to be possible to change. So I think the first thing I'm saying is that, God, it's grim out there. But it is possible to have a transformation. And I think my inspiration always comes from Jubilee 2000. You know, when we began the Jubilee 2000 campaign, people said to me, you can't possibly... You know, thank you. I was told you couldn't possibly run a national campaign, never mind a global campaign, to get the debt cancelled. But we did. And we did it by writing to people and explaining the system to people, to ordinary people, to people like you and I. You know? And the church has played a wonderful role in that. We would send out A4 briefings. Let's explain to you how multilateral debt works, bilateral debt. What's the difference with commercial debt? What is the net present value of debt? We'd explain all that, and none of it is rocket science. And people got the message. And nearly 100,000 turned up at Birmingham when the G7 arrived in 1998 to say, cancel the debt. And Blair was absolutely stunned that that many people cared about an issue as arcane third world debt. And that's what gives me inspiration. It's possible, you know, with understanding to bring about change and to bring about transformation, but we need understanding first. And finally, to your question about XR,
Now, what XR did with the insurance company was really important, because the insurance companies are going to face the biggest losses of all, because they're going to have to bail out all these corporations where they go under. And they have, some of them anyway, have been amongst the more enlightened of big corporates. Our problem actually, my view is, oil companies are a very big problem. But most big corporations are perfectly aware that this is serious, are perfectly aware that their supply lines are in danger, because they're thinking 10, 20, 30 years down the line, not like our government, which thinks about what's going to be in tomorrow's papers, right? Our real problem is our government, is the fact that, you know, we have a government with an 80-seat majority elected on what I think is a very narrow basis, basically, and self-interested and awful, corrupt, basically, nothing less than corrupt. A government that's wants to dismantle our big institutions, the institutions of which you're so proud. That's a big problem here. So somehow, you know, hurting the insurance companies on the one hand and the oil companies on the other, while not hurting politicians or governments, is something we have to also get the balance right for. And I'd like XR to have a more explicit, clear goal as to what they're going to do. I mean, awareness raising is one thing, but I would like to see XR become far more focused in their protests and exactly what we're trying to, in a bit in the way Just Stop Oil have got a single ask and demand. XR asks, and I don't want to be too critical, because they have done wonderful work so far in raising awareness and stirring the pot, if you like. We've got to, I think, be much more focused in our attacks and focused on the institutions and, in fact, the political institutions that we want to undermine in order to transform. Sorry.
Thank you. I'm going to go to Sarah. Thanks. I think you've probably got something important to say. I think that's working.
Yeah, is that working? Yes, it is. Hello, Anne. Thank you very much for the talk. Really sad you're leaving so soon, and I hope perhaps maybe I could get your email address. I'm working with a group of people from the Global South who've just set up a new campaign called Debt for Climate, which is more than debt swaps, but I promised them I'd find out some information from you about the Jubilee 2000 campaign. We just want to build up resource and so on, so I might like to get in touch with you about that. It's a private matter. What I really want to talk about is the story and the narrative, and to pick into what you were talking about with finance and to look at appropriation, because the country's the Jubilee debt campaign, the Debt for Climate, and what I'm involved in, which is Jubilee for Climate, all recognises that debt has built up as a consequence of colonialism, as a consequence of history, as a consequence of extraction and the unfair relationship. Now, when you talk about bringing finance back on shore, what do you do about the fact that we have offshored all those resources? So we've got like a 13-to-1 ratio in terms of the amount of money that's flowing in into the global north from the global south. It's 5-to-1 on land, 5-to-1 on energy, and so on and so forth. That's what the system is reliant upon. That's how we've made so much money. So the Just Stop Oil narrative doesn't really work when countries are so heavily in debt. So a couple of weeks ago, I put myself on the line to stop an African energy investment summit, because it seems absolutely, completely absurd that you would actually be investing. But it wasn't under Just Stop Oil. It had to carry Global South messages. And the Global South was saying, end oil colonialism, cancel the debt, invest in renewables. If you put the just in front of Stop Oil, then you allow a whole lot of inequality to be perpetuated and potentially exacerbated as they move out of oil and into new resource extraction.
I mean, what I think what we're facing here is the scale of the task, really. The debt is part of the global imbalance. As you know, I was born in South Africa, and I watch. Part of the problem is that currently the system is that the dollar is the world's reserve currency, and the dollar is backed by a big economy, the United States. And right now, the dollar is strengthening. It's going getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And every day, all the other currencies, and the South African currency in particular, is getting weaker. But because all debt is denominated in dollars, the value of debt is rising, right? So the debt becomes worse under those circumstances. But why is the dollar the world's reserve currency? Keynes wanted us to have a system whereby there was no single issuer of the world's reserve currency. That there was a sort of global central bank that managed balances between surplus and deficit countries, and issued a neutral currency called Bancor, is what he wanted it to be called. And that was defeated by the Americans, who wanted the dollar to have that power. And the really awful thing about the dollar, oh, I see what I've done. I've gone and unplugged something. The awful thing about the dollar is back in 1973, at the time of the oil crisis then, Nixon sent Kissinger to Saudi Arabia to do a deal with the Saudis. And the deal was, the Saudis would only sell oil in dollars. They wouldn't use any other currency. And those dollars would then flow back into the United States to pay for the US deficit. And so we have petrodollars. No country in the world, South Africa cannot pay for its oil in South African rands. Malawi can't pay for it in Malawian kwacha. Nigerians can't pay for refined oil because they grow their own oil, but they have to import refined oil. They can't use Naira to pay for that. They have to have US dollars. In order to have US dollars, they have to export commodities to earn those dollars, right? And that's really hard to do. If you want to buy pharmaceuticals because your country is facing the plague that is called COVID, you've got to have dollars. And as the dollar strengthens and your currency weakens, so it gets harder and harder for you to earn dollars. So, you know, it's a very unjust system. That's how poor countries built up debts. Because not just because they borrowed money, because they borrowed money in dollars and the value of the dollar changed while, you know, they were waiting to repay it. So, you know, I come back to the really tough nut to crack, which is the system. And even if we don't have a simple answer to how to change the system, I just want us to think more about it as a system, and not as good guys and bad guys, or as oil or debt or one thing, and separate from, you know, you can't separate poor country debt from the global financial system and the imbalances inherent in it. So, I'm not being very helpful here, but my aim is to get you to think about it in system terms. And the more we do that, the more we'll be able to think creatively about what to do about the system. I'm sorry that these are not adequate answers to your questions at all, but I suppose I'm really posing them myself.
Yes, my question is towards the psychology of what is happening at the top. I rather think that in 2007 there were quite a lot of people who knew there was going to be a collapse. But to say something in public, they'd have to break ranks. And the top people don't break ranks, that's how they stay there.
Yeah.
Now, the question I want to ask you is that when, I assume you've met some sympathetic people at the top, politicians and businessmen, when they talk to you sotto voce, what do they say? Is it après moi le déluge, or is it, you know, we can't do anything either. Your Green Deal's going nowhere because we can't do anything as well. Is it just stuck? Everything's stuck because nobody thinks anything can be done?
Just to give you an honest answer, I do speak to them, and they, you know, I find myself torn, really, because they are very worried. But they don't feel that individually, even as a big corporation, they can do something without a framework within which to do it. And so they are actually begging for more regulation. They're begging for, please tell us what you want. Please tell us what the timeline is that you want, oh government. Please tell us, you know, how we have to adjust. We will adjust. because we can see that this could be catastrophic for our businesses. I mean, of course, the oil companies don't say that, and the gas companies don't say that. But, I mean, even they must worry. Today, an oil, what is it called? It's an LNG unit in the United States that is just blown up today. That's going to affect the flow of LNG across the Atlantic. God knows why it blew up. But, you know, they face these challenges as well. And so I think what everyone is looking for, including big bad corporates, is a framework. Now, having said that, it's leadership and a framework. Having said that, they go to the COP26 and they go to Paris and they lobby like hell to have things not change. They go to the European Commission, which is trying to decide on a taxonomy, to decide on how to define what is green and what is black. You know, what is green and what is good and what is bad. And the nuclear lobbyists are in there. Who knows if they're right or wrong? Yeah, but the point is this, if we had real political leadership and courage, we wouldn't be saying to BlackRock, would you like to come and join the European Commission and advise us on how to develop our taxonomy? Because you're a big financial corporation, I'm sure you'd be able to help us. That's what we've done. John Kerry, when he was given the job by Biden to be the climate ambassador for the United States, in his very first press conference, he said, Mr. Larry Fink, chief executive BlackRock, I'm appealing to you to finance this transformation. Mr. BlackRock was ever so chuffed to be chosen in that way, and he swanned around for a bit and got himself in the Financial Times to say what a big shot he was. Last week he said, actually, we don't want that role. Right. It's ridiculous. Our politicians are the ones that are giving away that power. Mm. Our politicians lack the guts and the leadership to provide the framework and say to BlackRock, sorry, you're not allowed in the room when we discuss taxonomy. This is a democratic issue. It's got nothing to do with you. And you will do what a democratic government asks you to do. But we don't have politicians. Our politicians are mainly corrupted. So we're back to going after them.
Yes.
One more question?
I don't think so.
Oh, she's a very fierce chair. One quick back. Yeah? Just one last one.
Trade, it's your fault.
Who is?
Who is our Roosevelt? Have we got one? Who's our Roosevelt?
That's a very good question. No, we don't have one. But Roosevelts don't fall down out of the blue sky. They come out of movements. They come out from below. Zelensky is the only inspirational leader that I know of today. And he's there, he was brought there by the crowd. He was brought there most unexpectedly, right? He wasn't brought there by the corporates, he was brought there by civil society. So Mandela came out of people and out of a movement. So, you know, Roosevelt also came out of a movement. So what we need to have is the movement. We've got to be doing the working and the thinking and the grounding, and from that will, I think, emerge a leader. Hopefully, in time, to address the theme.
Well, I think we're all feeling a bit shell-shocked, aren't we? But thank you very much, Anne, and we much admire the way that you have persisted in this over the years and are so clear-thinking and are able to really get to the root of the problem. Which is enormous as it faces up to it. I only want to say that we have got to, at the same time, hold on to that little word hope and the possibility that we can change. And the fact that you've illustrated that from some of the major things, I think a lot of us very much inspired by the suffrage movement particularly and anti-apartheid, to show that things can genuinely change. But I think we must, those of us who pray must pray. And even those of us who haven't prayed up to now, please start. So thank you very much indeed. And do go and get your train. But